Financial technology, or fintech, is one of the fastest growing industries in the world today, with New York, London, Tel Aviv, Edinburgh, Singapore, Moscow, and other major cities all vying for a piece of the action. Welcome to Breaking Banks, the first dedicated radio show that focuses on how this new boom is changing everything, from the way we bank to the very concept of money itself. Now, here's your host, Brett King.
Welcome back to Breaking Banks. I'm joining you live from New York City today. I actually just moved. I was talking to Jim about this before the show. I just moved apartments, and so I haven't fully set up the new studio yet. But I do have the computer and the microphone set up, and I've got a blanket over me to make sure the noise is limited. So there you go. I'm not going to show you on video, Dave, but we've got a few of our friends. This is the end of the year show, review of 2017 progress. So as you heard, Dave Birch is on the line. How are you, Dave?
Great. Thanks very much, Brett.
My producer has in the notes here, the wryest man in fintech. I don't know if he's the wryest man, maybe the driest man, but anyway, no, that doesn't work either.
I take it as a compliment, but thank you.
Yeah, absolutely. And we have Jim Marouse from the financial... Marouse. I always fake myself out with that. I was like, Jim, great to have you back on. Of course, Jim is from the Financial Brand and the Digital Banking Report. We're going to talk about one of the new digital banking reports coming out next week on the show. But Jim, great to have you back on.
Great to be here.
And we have from Provoke Media, co-hosting the show with me today, or just joining the conversation, actually, Ron Shevlin, the host of The Snark Tank. Hey, Ron.
Hey, Brett. Great to be here.
Great to have you back on the show, dude. And Theo Lau, who was just named a LinkedIn top voice in fintech and, of course, femtech. Hey, Theo, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, so quite a collection of fintech experts to talk about what's happening in the space and what has happened in the space in 2017. But before we get to that, I first have to thank our sponsor, efinancialcareers.com. They're the world's leading career site for financial service professionals for over 15 years. Now, efinancialcareers.com partners with leading finance and fintech firms. So, if you're in the search for a job, your CV, your resume is seen by all the top companies and recruiters in the US and abroad. Now, as we all know, this is a space, the financial services space is a very dynamic, ever-changing space right now. And eFinancial Careers provides valuable resources from helpful career coaching to interview strategies and tools that keep you up to speed and well-informed with what's happening now in the industry and what it means for your career. That's why they partner with Breaking Banks as well, because we are FinTech Central when it comes to strategies and news in the space. So check them out, efinancialcareers.com/Breaking Banks. Registration is free for Breaking Banks listeners and financial professionals, so make sure you take advantage of all the resources they have to offer. That's efinancialcareers.com/Breaking Banks. Now, we have one conference announcement coming up for January. We're starting on 2018 announcements already. That is the Amsterdam FinTech Forum on January 25th. Go to amsterdamfintechforum.com to register today. And, of course, breakingbanks.com will have the link to that conference. Okay, so back to the show today. Now, in 2013... we started this show to document the changes that were happening and to talk about the possibilities of the fintech or financial technology sector. Now, back then, fintech was a word that a lot of people were hearing about, but not a lot of people knew about. But today, fintech is a very common term. Everyone's talking about it. It's synonymous with banking or financial services. But like all disruptions, the tech is just sort of an implication now. And any company that isn't a tech company in financial services now is struggling or seems outdated. So ironically, the hallmark of a good tech company is customer centricity, rather than channel or product centricity. Now, I think most banks have probably got that message, but The reason we brought the team on today, this group of experts, is to really talk about, you know, what has fintech achieved in 2017? Who are the breakout examples of fintech? You know, what have we learned in the process? And where are we likely to go next year as a result of what we've seen happening this year? So I'll kick it off. And I'll ask for the group to give me their thoughts on what do you think was the biggest success story in terms of fintech in 2017. Maybe Jim, we can start with you.
Well, I think the thing that we saw, and not a specific organization or something like that, was that we really saw a movement, a significant movement, towards the partnering with fintech firms, with legacy financial institutions. And we had talked about this, and the movement from organizations seeing fintech firms as competitors versus actually seeing them as partners really took hold in 2017. In fact, our research we just completed on the retail banking trends and predictions, we saw that 38% of organizations that we surveyed globally said they've established a partnership with a fintech firm. And that was half of that last year.
Sorry, can you give me the percentage again, Jim? What percentage?
It's 38% have established a partnership with fintech firms, and another 27% say they're going to do so in 2018. Now, we still have, you know, 40%, a little bit more than 40% saying they have no plans to partner with fintech firm. But we're seeing that being almost exclusively in the community bank sector. So the smaller banks just are not looking in that direction for the most part. But I think this is a huge change from last year at this time, where the partnerships really are taking hold.
Yeah. So this was something that this is sort of pretty distinct move in over the last 12, 18 months, whereas before there was an increasing tendency for banks to copy what fintechs were doing. But now I think they've discovered it's faster and cheaper to partner.
Oh, exactly.
Yeah, okay. All right, so hey, let's go to Dave. Dave, what do you think was the big fintech success story of or the most important fintech developments in 2017?
Well, I've got a couple of different answers to that, actually. But I mean, I think what was the most important fintech thing? I think it probably wasn't even reported as a fintech story or in the fintech press. But because I read all these crazy books like Augmented, I think you saw this story a few weeks ago. Google, instead of teaching the computer how to play chess, they let the computer teach itself.
And the computer, they just gave it the rules.
They gave it the rules. It played itself for a day and then beat like the top computer program.
Yeah.
And I can't help feeling, you know, we're getting to that point. We've been talking about AI entering the mainstream. And I think it's really going to happen next year, because the focus at the moment has been on the kind of machine learning kind of things, which you'd expect, because the banks have masses of data that they don't necessarily, you know, do useful things with. So for the fintech startups, focusing on machine learning has been a good bet. And the spending has tended to go into anti-fraud stuff, because, you know, it's a good target for machine learning, you know, transaction patterns and that kind of thing. But I think next year, you know, that Google thing was just a little, what economists would call a weak signal for change. You know, when you look back on what banking looks like in 5 years' time, I think you'll see that as one of the sort of key developments. Because, you see, the thing is, in a lot of the fintech things I go to, people are talking about robo-advice and chatbots and stuff like that. But that's not really the vision of banking 5 years down the line, because it won't just be the banks that have the AI. The customers will have the AI too. It's not going to be, you know, the bank showing stupid adverts of horses running around or whatever it is on television trying to persuade me to take out a mortgage. It's the bank's robot talking to my robot, and I'm going to choose a robot that represents my interests. You know, I'll choose between, you know, maybe the Association of Retired People, or, I mean, whatever. I'll choose the robot I think will serve my interests. And it's a completely different financial services business.
Jim?
I'm sorry, I was just going to say, David, I think that also plays into the partnership thing that I was talking about, where there's not many financial institutions, except the very biggest ones, that I have the staff on.
They can, build AI.
Yeah. I think it does. It favors the incumbents, frankly. I think it's very difficult for the up-and-coming guys to get in on this. Although, I suppose the AI guys would argue the stuff that Google is putting out there, like TensorFlow and things like that. I mean, right now, people are using it to paste their faces onto porn stars. But, I mean, give it 2 or 3 years' time, and maybe people will be using...
I knew you were going to mention that.
That's my favorite story of the week. That. How could I not mention that story? Well, but you see what I mean? Like, in 2 or 3 years' time, those kids that are using it to make fake movies right now, in 2 or 3 years' time, they'll be doing financial services stuff with it.
So if you guys are interested in this, next week's show, I'm interviewing Ben Goertzel from Hanson Robotics. Hanson is the creator of Sophia, the robot, you know, the one that got citizenship in Saudi Arabia recently.
Oh, yeah.
I recorded this show last night. He called in, you know, we spoke to him from Hong Kong, and it's a really, really interesting show on how AI is being formed and, the work that SingularityNet is doing and others, and it's going to blow you away. Really, really interesting stuff. But anyway, all right, so, Ron, what do you think about what was big in 2017?
Hey, before I answer that, Brett, let me just address some of Dave's and Jim's comments. First of all, Dave doesn't just read crazy books. He actually writes crazy books, and everybody should check out his crazy book. But I totally agree with
Babylon Beyond Bitcoin.
There you go. Thank you. But I totally agree with Dave about the AI, and that 2017 wasn't the year in which AI became a reality, but it was the year in which a 40-year-old technology gained legitimacy in the industry and beyond. So that was, I think, what was relevant about that. I also want to touch on Jim's point about partnerships. If you've seen me speak at any of a couple conferences lately, you know I've got a favorite slide in which I put up a picture of Jack Nicholson from the movie A Few Good Men and say that I always think about that picture when I hear partnerships, because I always think of Nicholson saying, "You want partnership? You can't handle partnerships." True. Because the reality is that most banks and credit unions, especially in the U.S., have no capabilities for partnering with fintech companies. And I actually suspect that a lot of the large banks aren't really partnering with them either. I think what's happening here is that the fintech startups are the new fintech vendors in this space. You know, we go to Finovate and we hear practically every presenter say, and we're looking for bank partners. No, you're looking for banks to pay you for stuff. You're not looking for partnerships. And so I think we're overusing that term.
Fintechs need revenue too, dude.
Yeah, absolutely. And so, partnerships, there's no shared risk, shared reward stuff. They're looking for money. I think it's a vendor relationship. The other thing that I would add to this conversation, though, that I think was really important about 2017 was finally the year that P2P, electronic P2P payments just kind of became super legit. Clearly, for the past couple years, Venmo has built up its volume very impressively. But I think it was this year that the banks finally said, man, we're getting our butts kicked on this stuff. And then Apple jumped in, Facebook jumped in, and Zelle pretended to be a new player.
Let alone what's happening in China with 92% of mobile payments being shifted to, you know, Ant Financial, Alipay, and WeChat, Tencent WeChat Pay.
Well, and Brad, I think that's the underlying thread of the story, is that the real thing is that the P2P payment providers are really posing themselves as threats to the mainstream retail B2C providers. That you start going into retail shops, playing with Venmo, paying with Square, and that's I don't think the banks saw that the P2P players would be a threat to their retail transaction volume.
But now they're getting it. Yeah. All right.
Can I just add a little bit to that, Ron, before we move on? Because Ron's right about that. That's a critical thing. What I would say about that is I've heard, in fact, I've read in several places, for the Chinese banks, the loss of the transaction revenues that come from those because those revenues have shifted away. Actually, they kind of already factored that into their strategies, because everybody knows that payment fees are asymptotic to zero. You can't make a business plan on payment fees into the future. What disrupts the bank strategies is the loss of the data that goes
with it. Yeah, the behavioral payment data.
Of course, because all they see is WeChat, Alipay, Alipay, Alipay. They've no idea what customers are doing, what they're buying.
Yeah.
And it's that loss of data, not the fee. So I think Ron's right to highlight that one.
Yeah, good, good. Okay, Theo, what do you think, 2017? Now, you have a bit broader of a look, because you look at InsurTech and some other stuff as well, but what do you think was big in 2017?
Yeah, I do. Actually, my first answer was going to be similar to what Jim was saying, is, you know, with all the events and, you know, conferences that we all go to, you know, I feel that the sentiment this year is very different than last year, right? You know, like what Jim was talking about, it's not us versus them, it's more what can we do together, because I think in the end of the day they both realize that they need each other to survive. Right, so that was something interesting. And that's the same thing with insurance companies when you're talking about it. I noticed that actually some of the banks, they start partnering with insurance companies to offer them services to expedite the electronic payments. And it's for the same thing, right? They're thinking about how can we work together to survive, and how can I, for example, U.S. Bank is working with Zelle, you know, and also I think someone called Supplier Before Pay to help with insurance companies. And it's the same sentiment, right? They have the pressure to innovate. They know they need to do something different. It's not a nice to do. It's a must have. But the other part I was going to touch on, what I like, hearing more in 2017 is financial inclusion. That's something that's a theme that I start hearing, in Money 2020 this year, obviously, and even earlier this year. In various forums, there are 2 billion adults in the world without access to, you know, formal banking services. So that's a good area for us to focus in. Do well while you do good.
Yeah. Well, so in the insurance space, Theo, you know, because the insurers started a little late in terms of this technology revolution, you know, for things like claims processing using AI and, you know, getting rid of, paper forms and stuff like that, are we seeing sort of an accelerated time frame here in terms of fintechs coming into the space?
In the U.S.? I'm not too sure.
Okay.
You're looking at the structure of it, right? I mean, in the end of the day, we still have 50 states to deal with, and all of them have slightly different regulation. I think it's pretty hard. a little different compared to
Who ever thought that was a good idea? Hey, Ron?
Right.
Yeah? Anyway. All right. So actually, let's go with that. In respect to sort of regulated environments, which country or jurisdiction do you guys think did the best this year in terms of making advancements in innovation or creating a platform for innovation in their economy?
Well, I'd put my hand up and try and get votes for the UK on this one here, Brett, because You haven't quite seen the impact yet, but the UK's decision to go ahead with real open banking, ahead of the PSD2 stuff, we've got in the UK what are called the CMA, the Competition and Markets Authority, the CMA, what they call the remedies. The government decided that there wasn't enough competition in the banking space. They instituted this Competition and Markets Authority inquiry. They came up with a bunch of remedies, and one of them is to have the open APIs. So in mid-January, the 9 biggest banks in the UK have to open up their APIs. Those APIs are already published, by the way. You can get them on GitHub and start playing around with them. And that means in a very short time, we're going to be an entirely new competitive landscape, because this is unlike anything we've had before. You know, you'll be able to, I mean, provided you meet certain licensing conditions, obviously, you'll be able to go to customers and say, can I have access to your bank account? And if they give you access, you can instruct payments for them, you can slurp up the data from their account, you can come back to them with offers, you can learn all kinds of things about them.
Is that a technical term, slurp up the data?
That's my technical term. It's my technical term. There's going to be a lot of slurping going on. Because if I say, hey, look, Brett, if you want car insurance, why don't you give me access to your bank account and I'll have a look at your regular spending.
Slurp through the appy.
Yeah, no, of course they'll slurp it. And then that feeds back into the machine learning AI stuff we were talking about earlier on. So I would like to put a hand up and say I think the UK is doing something amazing on the regulatory front, which is really going to change the banking sector. And I think a lot of people haven't taken on board just what a revolutionary change that's going to be.
Oh, Dave, no way. Dave, I'm sorry. I got to disagree with you on this one. What Leandra English accomplished in her 5 minutes as executive director of the CFPB outstrips everything else that happened in the world this year. Actually, Dave, I agree with you 100% about the UK.
That's what you're going to get more of that on Snark Tank, the new podcast from Ron Shevlin coming out soon. All right. So, hey, Jim, what are your thoughts? You do a fair bit of travel globally. You've run into a lot of regulators. What do you think?
Yeah, you know what? I have to go along with David because I think, and it's not necessarily what has already happened, it's what's on the horizon. I think there are so many organizations in that sandbox right now in the playground that they're going to just, what can be done. I mean, we're already starting to see it with some of the more aggressive fintech firms over there. But I think when we see the traditional banks start to open up their APIs and start to really look beyond maybe banking, and I think we're getting close to the point where we're going to see what I'll say beyond banking, open API and open banking platforms where there'll be everything from transportation to a traditional e-commerce. And I think the U.S. will again lag. I mean, it's easy to say China, but I think as far as what's exciting,
it's pronounced China. China.
Okay.
Sorry.
China. Okay. But I think what's going on in the U.K. is really something to watch. And it'll be interesting to see, how the U.S., if the U.S. responds at all.
Well, yeah, this is where it's interesting. The Hong Kong regulator back in October came out with seven guidelines or seven themes to regulatory reform in Hong Kong. And Norman Chan, the head of the HKMA, he said, "We left it to the incumbents. We're not innovating fast enough. It's the assessment of the HKMA that unless we open this up to fintechs to compete and push the innovation faster, that in the end, Hong Kong will lose its place as an international financial center without a strong commitment to innovation." And so if you look at that then in terms of what's happening in the US, you know, for example, the fact that, Singapore, Hong Kong, EU all have fintech charter, licensing structures in place. And, the UK is what, 18 challenger banks right now, Dave? Is that right?
Yeah, I'm probably off the mainstream on this one because I'm not utterly convinced that those new entrants are genuinely challengers to the incumbents. I'm not the only person who thinks this, and I know I'm thinking from a technical perspective, but there are quite a few people who think that actually the real challengers are the people that are already in place with the millions of customers. In other words, when those bank APIs open up, it's not some kids in a garage who are going to put together the thing that's going to challenge Barclays. You know, because Facebook, Google, Amazon, Apple, they already have millions of customers. And once they can get direct access to the banking system, like if you can sit in Facebook and just ask Facebook, oh, how much money do I have in my Barclays account? And Facebook can come back and tell you, why are you going to come out of Facebook and run some stupid bank app to find this stuff?
To the point, when you could just ask your Siri, what's my balance?
Yeah, and Apple will have said to you, hey, can we have access to your bank account? You've okayed it. So I'm beginning to worry about the word challengers. I'm not sure that's the right word. New niche banks might be a better word.
Okay, well, we could call them neobanks.
Well, and neobank, yes, I mean, neobank, except because
that was you came up with that.
I know, but by neobank I mean something that isn't a bank. So neobank is what I would call moving.
Okay.
Because, you know, it's not a bank, but to the customer, it looks like a bank.
Yeah.
So right. I would call that a neobank. Sorry.
All right. So
my taxonomy is bizarre.
That's fine. So Theo, what are your thoughts in terms of jurisdictionally, which regions do you like?
Not the U.S. Sorry.
You're allowed to say that. You're allowed to say that.
I am, because I was not born here. I think the U.K., I agree with you guys. Singapore is another place that's really interesting. When Jim was talking about going beyond banking, right? So it was a story I read earlier today about DBS and how it was trying to create an online marketplace for cars. So, I mean, you know, when you buy a car, you have to go to a bank to get a loan anyway. So what they're thinking is, why don't we expand the service and let our customers come in, look for a car, budget how much they need to get the car, and provide them with special interest rates, right? And I would say the same philosophy can be extended to other loan services. So if that's the case, they can move beyond what they traditionally provide and expand what services they offer instead of just a traditional bank. And so in that regard, I think the UK and Asia, the Far East, are very, very interesting.
Hey, Brett, if I can jump in, because I do want to address Theo's point. Theo, I was born in the U.S., and I have no qualms in saying that it wasn't the U.S. who led in regulatory movement either. But I think that the important point is why it didn't. And I think it's too easy to kind of, well, just, you know, the left's just going to blame Trump. But I think the reality is that we started from a position of a philosophical differences in the U.S. than what the regulatory situation is in other countries. We've got a situation here where one party fundamentally views banks as all evildoers. And, you know, a lot of that comes from a senator from my state. I live in Massachusetts. So when you're starting from that philosophical position, you've got a problem in trying to get regulatory change done. I've been doing a survey for the past couple of years of mid-sized bank and credit union CEOs, and going into this year, they were really optimistic about the regulatory changes that were going to come from the new administration. And I'm pretty sure when I field my survey in the next couple of weeks, they're going to tell me they were really disappointed that those changes didn't come about. So it's a whole lot slower, and a lot of it has to come with it comes as a result of the situation we started with and the philosophical differences that exist.
Well, you know, we only got 3 minutes before the break, but, you know, part of the challenge in the U.S. was after the Great Depression, there was a strong preference towards community banking, because the feeling was that by distributing deposits amongst smaller institutions, they would be more robust and there's less of a chance of a run on what it was termed back then as a foreign bank, large centrally owned institutions. And there's distributed deposit base would prevent sort of a run on the bank bringing banks down. But that architecture we created for the banking system around community banks and state charters and so forth, it really doesn't fit with the digital world today, right?
Yeah, agreed.
Yeah. So, all right. So, guys, listen, just before we take a quick break, I do want you guys, when we come back, I want to talk about what's going to be big in 2018. But let me ask you guys a quick question. How many of you still have some Bitcoin?
Well, I've got two lots of Bitcoin. There's the Bitcoins I forgot the password to, and I don't know how many of those there are, probably 0.1. And then there's the Bitcoins on my phone. That's another like 0.01. And then there's the Bitcoins in my hard wallet, which is in front of me even as I speak. And that's another 0.01. So I'm like $27 up on this, I think.
Oh, very cool.
Oh, yeah. It's all the rage. Hadn't you heard?
That's all the rage. Jim, what you got any Bitcoin at the moment?
I got Ethereum. I did not get Bitcoin.
You got Ethereum?
I was a late arrival, but I justified in my mind by buying it as a Christmas gift to my wife and son, but they don't know yet. And so they either get a bigger gift than what I thought I was going to get them, or a smaller gift.
There you go. All right, Theo, Ron?
That's a good idea, Jim.
Theo, Ron, do either of you have any Bitcoin at the moment?
Well, I think my IBM AT386 from 1985 is still clunking away trying to mine some Bitcoin. So ask me again in a couple weeks.
Yeah, does it have a GPU?
Too busy saving for retirement.
All right. Well, so just some weird news take us to break. I don't know whether you guys saw this, but this would be just my luck. So Uber charged a passenger in Toronto over $14,000 US. So it's $18,518 Canadian for a 5 mile ride across Toronto. So initially was it
surge price? Is that what surge pricing
surge
is?
Pricing.
I've heard about it.
Surge pricing. anyway, they declined to refund it at the start until someone tweeted out about it, and it was obviously refunded. But how would you feel if you saw that in your Uber receipt? $18,518 for a 5 mile trip.
Hey, as long as it gives me something to blog about, I don't mind.
There you go. All right, so let's go to a quick break, and we'll be back right after these words from our sponsors.
Become our friend on Facebook. Post your thoughts about our shows and network on our timeline. Visit facebook.com/Voice America.
What do financial services of the future look like? Invisible yet ubiquitous, blended into our lives like air, gravity. This podcast. Temenos has specialized for 20 years in creating the best financial technology for thousands of financial institutions worldwide. Our open fintech marketplace allows millions of people to experience money in exciting new ways. Join the most vibrant financial services ecosystem in the world. Temenos, we make the money go round.
The future of online TV is here. View exclusive content from your favorite talk radio hosts and new programs that you can't see anywhere else. Visit voiceamerica.tv today.
Now, before we get back to talking about fintech, I want to take a quick moment to tell you about eFinancialCareers.com, one of the supporters of the show. They're the world's leading career site for financial service professionals for over 15 years. eFinancialCareers.com partners with leading financial and fintech firms, so your resume is seen by all the top companies and recruiters in the US and abroad. Now, as we all know, financial services is a very dynamic, ever-changing industry, and eFinancial Careers provides valuable resources from helpful career coaching to interview strategies and tools that keep you up to speed and well-informed with what's happening now in the industry and what it means for your career. Registration's free for financial professionals. Make sure you take advantage of all the resources they have to offer. So check them out, eFinancialCareers.com.
Listening to Breaking Banks featuring your host, Brett King. To reach the show today, please call 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. Or join the conversation on Twitter by using the hashtag Breaking Banks. Now, back to the program.
Welcome back. This is Brett King. We are live from New York. We have joining us from Woking in the UK, Dave Birch. Say hello, Dave.
Hi, guys.
We have Ron Shevlin up in Boston, Massachusetts.
Hey there.
With Jim Marus. Where are you? In Cleveland, Jim?
I am in Cleveland today.
Yep, good. And Theo's in Washington, I gather, right?
Yep, I am. Not traveling this week.
Very cool. Let me ask you guys, which is the fintech you heard most about in 2017? Which fintech name did you hear pretty consistently, or more than others?
That's an interesting question. So on the payment side, I would say Stripe continues to make waves. I mean, I'm so impressed by that company, and they keep moving forwards. Interesting. I think Square got back on the agenda as well, though, didn't it? So I mean, that was. I mean, I still count them as a fintech, so that was pretty interesting. Yep. There was a lot of stuff going on in the lending side, especially the SME people. Klarna did very well on the payment side, turning themselves into an amazing pan-European operation. So I tell you, because of the stuff I was working, I attended mainly to look at that payment stuff.
Yeah. All right, Jim?
you know, you could easily fall into the Tencent or Alibaba camp, but I think it's Venmo. I think Venmo, possibly because of all the emphasis around Zelle, that Venmo just really, they keep on working on their platform, as does PayPal. And I think those two together, really, in the U.S. at least, dominated the news. If you're talking about any type of fintech, I'd say that in the payment space, the P2P space, as Ron mentioned, it was really Venmo and PayPal.
Okay, Ron?
I would have said PayPal slash Venmo myself. I think PayPal's just kicking ass in the market right now with a lot of different things, not just the P2P side. They've got a lot of things going. The other thing I would add to it is, even though it's not a fintech company per se, you cannot have a conversation these days about fintech without the word Amazon coming up. And you know what? Here's a company that did $1 billion in merchant cash advances this year, which is a financial product, and did it with basically $0 cost of acquisition, and that's pretty damn incredible. And also, just quickly, I fielded a consumer survey recently, and I told respondents that Amazon was thinking about offering a checking account and was going to do so by bundling checking with value-added services like cell phone damage protection and identity theft protection, and was going to charge $5 to $10 a month. And the percentage of consumers, in particular older millennials, I split the millennial group between the 20s and the 30s, and interestingly, it was the 30-year-old, the 30-somethings, who were really interested in giving up their existing bank accounts for this. So as you kind of look out to the next 2 years, I think what Amazon does is just holding, you know, like a cloud hanging over the industry in the U.S.
Yeah, that's a good shout, Rob.
The older millennial, or older millennials, the top end of that group right now, seems to be doing a whole lot more because they're more in the, they have more income and they're starting to buy houses, you know, at the top end of that group.
Yeah. All right. So Theo, who do you make the call out to?
PayPal, definitely, for sure, everywhere. Another one I was going to add is Clink.
Clink got a lot of traction. I like what they did. I think they're punching far above their weight for the size of the organization and the investment they've taken in. They're doing really well.
Yep, definitely. You see Jason everywhere you go. And another one is Betterment. They've done really, really well this year, and they're doing some good stuff.
Yeah, we should get John Stein back on the show to give us an update. It's been about 18 months, I guess, since we had John on the show, so should get him back on. All right, so that's good feedback. So Jim, you know, coming back to your research that you've done recently and the fintech and bank collaboration, you know, can you give us some insights into why it is that banks have sort of changed their tune on this? What's driving them to partner with fintechs?
I was with a what I call a very large fintech, industry provider yesterday, and it really gets down to the need to move forward. Most organizations are still getting in their own way, and now they are at least admitting it and realizing that the only way they're going to be able to move forward, and a lot of it has to do with talent, is partnering. They just can't get the talent. In addition, they'll get halfway through a project and lose somebody, and there's just not enough backup. So what they're having to do is find somebody who either already has the solution, or if they're building something brand new, they're looking for an organization that has enough mass that they're going to be able to take them to the next step. So that, you know, we sometimes forget that companies like Fiserv and Deluxe and FIS and all this are just oversized fintechs to a degree. But I think the whole partnering concept now, we're seeing from the very biggest banks as well, that they're just having to go beyond their own four walls to get the talent and get the capabilities that they need.
So don't forget, if you guys are listening out there and you're listening on the live stream on Voice America, or you're listening on the AM band or wherever you're listening, and you want to participate in the conversation, you've got a question for us or a question for the group, please, you know, tweet us at BreakingBanks1 or at Brett King, and we'll get your question on the show and get talking about that. So that's your opportunity to be a part of the conversation. All right, so guys, let me sort of shift gears a little bit here for a moment. This year, obviously, we've had massive growth in cryptocurrencies. We talked about Bitcoin briefly before the break. But the other thing that's come out is tokens and ICOs. And so how important do you think this is as a development? Even though ICOs and tokens have been around for a while, undoubtedly this year was the big year for ICOs. Over $4 billion in early stage investment coming through ICOs in this year alone, which is makes it bigger than the early stage VC market in the US. But where do you think it's going to go with ICOs in 2018? Maybe Dave, do you want to start with that one?
Yeah, well, actually, my crackpot theory about this is I think tokens.
You're very good at those.
Crackpot theories. They're the only theories I have. Every time I say my other theory, which is I think Bitcoin is a bit of a bubble, it goes up another $1,000 without fail. So I'll put that one to one side. Yeah. I genuinely think that the token and ICO marketplace is potentially much more important to the future of financial services and the cryptocurrency stuff. And the reason for that is that I think the regulated, I mean, I know at the moment it's a wild west and lots of people are going to go to jail and money keeps vanishing and blah, blah, blah. All of this is true. But a regulated token market creates a new kind of digital asset that we just didn't have before, which is conceptually much closer to a kind of corporate private money. And there are all sorts of reasons for thinking that the more efficient markets, because they're markets without clearing and settlement, that the more efficient markets, essentially the foreign exchange markets between different companies' monies, are actually a sensible part of a financial services future. So I know the token stuff looks crazy right now, but there are real serious intellectual reasons for thinking that a regulated token market is going to be a new kind of digital asset and a more efficient way of corporate fundraising and trading. That's what I think you're going to see emerge next year.
Mm. So because there's been different market by market approaches, you know, we've seen Singapore embrace ICOs. We've seen the UK tend on the side of allowing ICOs. But, the SEC has come out and said, we're not sure. If it looks like a security, then you can't do it. But they haven't sort of said what you can do, as long as it,
And I think, as voters and taxpayers would want the SEC to err on the side of consumer protection. Because remember, there's going to be a huge backlash from all this stuff. In a few months' time, there are going to be people that have lost millions of dollars, voters that have lost millions of dollars, and there's going to be a huge backlash and calls for regulation. So it makes sense to kind of think about what that regulation should look like now. So I wouldn't disagree with what people like the SEC are doing. The Chinese regulators have said, look, let's just pause it for a while until we know how to regulate this stuff properly. Mm. And that, to me, seems quite a wise way forward. I'm looking at a story, I just Googled token ICOs because I just wanted to see what the latest stories were. And I'm looking at a story of a token called Confido. They raised $375 million and they've disappeared. No one knows what they are. Help, I want my anonymous, untraceable electronic money back.
Oh, God. Confido, I haven't heard of them.
Confido, $375 million.
That's big.
And they've
vanished. So that's the biggest ICO, right?
Oh, no. I think some of them are up at sort of 200. Oh, yeah, 375 is biggest. It might be. I think the Tezos, when I had dinner with Arthur.
Yeah, Tezos was like 300 million.
Well, I think they raised like 250, but it went up to like 400.
Yeah, true.
So I think when I saw them last time, it was like $400 million. But anyway, the point is, there's all sorts of roguery. People are going to jail. But there's something there.
No, they didn't raise 347 million. They raised 347,000.
Oh,
it's a big difference.
I'm looking at the wrong. I'm looking 375,000 or so. I'm looking at the wrong thing here. Yeah. Okay. So it wasn't as much as Tezos. I thought more people would have heard about it.
Tezos has had its own issues.
Everybody has a couple of class action lawsuits, don't they?
No. But this is more about the fact that they got so much money they didn't know what to do with it.
That's completely true.
Yeah.
But the point I'm making is that there are people that are involved in all Tezos aren't, by the way. There are people that are involved in all sorts of roguery. But that doesn't mean that there isn't really something here. And I think if you pay attention to the tokens and you imagine what a regulated token market would look like, and now you've got people like Indiegogo going into that space, I think tokens will be big next year. Don't be put off by the crazy stuff that's going on at the moment.
Okay. Theo, what are your thoughts about the token market and ICOs?
Proceed with caution. I think that's what I was going to say. There was a really cool chart yesterday on Business Insider that shows, it's an animation that shows how it has exploded throughout the last few years. And it's fascinating. I posted on Twitter earlier. It's immense, right? And it offers a really interesting or a different way for people to raise money outside of the traditional VC funding, which is good. In a sense, but I think the flip side of that is I also worry that it's a little bit of a wild, wild west out there.
Is this partially driven by the fact you've got all these early stage Bitcoin investors who've made all this money in crypto and now, are trying to find ways to spend it?
Yeah, potentially. People have too much time. I would say there are other things we need to worry about, and the one thing I tell people is just whatever it is that you do, it's fund money. Do not use that as retirement fund.
Okay. All right. Yeah, because you're big into the retirement stuff, so terms of your
we're going to be living for 100 years, right?
Well, you got to make the money last longer. Exactly. All right. So, Jim, you got any feelings on, and Ron, what about from a U.S. perspective? We don't hear a lot about ICOs. There is, of course, the school of thought that as long as you're taking in, registered, SEC-registered investors, it really doesn't matter in the U.S., right?
So my question is, does the governmental units that regulate haven't been able to get a decent regulation put together for fintechs and for quasi-banks and neobanks, whatever you want to call them. Why do we think that in the next 12 months they're going to be able to get their heads together with possibly involving themselves with other governments to get tokens together? I mean, it baffles my mind how slow, well, I guess it doesn't surprise me, but the marketplace is moving so much faster than governments, and our government seems to be right now the slowest. I mean, our neighbors up north are moving a lot faster.
Is that because of the extensive fintech advisory infrastructure the new administration has put in place?
They were slow before. I mean, you went to the White House.
That was a joke, by the way. I don't think. Did you hear Sarah Huckabee Sanders' response about Bitcoin?
No, I can only imagine.
No, so she said Homeland Security is looking into it. So,
and get your mind out of the gutter. I'm sorry, maybe that was another
one. That was another one. So, Ron, what are your thoughts in terms of U.S., in terms of where we're going to go with ICOs and tokens?
I think Jim's spot on this. I think if you think back to the Gartner hype cycle, ICOs are pretty much at the top, about to head down to the trough for some period of time, at least from a U.S. perspective, as the regulatory issues get discussed and dealt with. But I want to go back to a comment Dave made about sort of dismissing cryptocurrencies. Dave, I'll tell you, my take on this is that the big opportunity and potential here is less about cryptocurrency as currency as it is cryptocurrencies as a form of decentralized application that becomes a model for other types of applications. And so that's why I'm not writing off the cryptocurrency stuff. Any thoughts on that?
No, I mean, I agree with you, but I mean, I'm not writing off. And I certainly do think that there is a perfectly valid argument, which actually I subscribe to, that the real innovation will come at the appallingly badly named smart contracts layer, what you've correctly called the application layer. I think that's absolutely true. What I'm skeptical about is whether the underlying cryptocurrencies become currencies in mass market use. And the reason I think that is because I have a suspicion that the decentralization of currency... See, if anybody can make money, which is where we're going to, which money would you use? And I have a feeling, I can't prove it with bar charts or spreadsheets, that people will want to use money that somehow reflects their values. And this kind of libertarian, well, pseudo-libertarian West Coast value set actually appeals to, you know, the kind of Bitcoin mentality actually appeals to very few people. You could imagine, for example, like an Islamic cryptocurrency, which would have 1 billion users. Mm. And people would use it because of the values that it embodied. You know,
yeah, particularly if it was, Islamic, Sharia compliant.
Yeah. Non-interest bearing and those kind of things.
My feeling
is the technology will be sent decentralized into lots of different communities. And so I can't help but feel that these communities will become the center of these different kinds of money, you know, rather than these big cryptocurrencies.
Yeah, it's funny. To me, it's ironic that we keep harping on how Bitcoin's price exceeded 15,000, 16,000, 17,000. 17,000 what? Dollars. U.S. dollars. So we're still denominating it in a U.S. currency and you know, yelling about it. There was a great
article. It's arbitrary classification, U.S. dollars.
But the point, Brett, is that it's not arbitrary. It's backed by something, and that's the important. There was a great article in the Wall Street Journal this week written by a guy who was a law professor down at Duke, and that caught my eye because he used to run the online channel practice at Wachovia, a guy named Lawrence Baxter. And he wrote a great argument of why Bitcoin's going to go to zero because of whole reasons about not being backed by anything real in value. And what's interesting is, you know, we keep talking about the younger generation, about being more values-oriented, and Bitcoin is not backed by anything of value substance or anything that produces value in the economy. So I'm kind of with Lawrence on this one. I think, you can ride the bubble right now, and maybe it'll go to 20,000 and 30,000, who knows what. But at some point, that bubble's got to burst.
So I tell you, I got a different view of this, which is the thesis I explored in Bank 4.0. So you guys will read this at some point. But, if you look at the global capital market structure, obviously stock markets are going up and up and up, and that's all good. But the other element of this is that, the commodities markets have been sort of in a sustained, depressed level of activity because oil is going down and oil's not coming back up, right? And energy represents over half of the global commodities market in terms of trade. So if you've got sustained lower energy prices with shifts to solar and so forth, then that capital that we've stuck in commodities markets over time to sort of try and raise interest has to go somewhere. There's not enough room in the stock market. So we should look at digital cryptocurrencies as digital commodities.
I think Ron's point, which is that it's the applications on top, which will be the digital commodities, the tokens, in other words.
Right.
I think that stacks up. I think there's an intellectual thing to that. I would say, Brett, I think I saw a thing earlier on when people were saying, there's this kind of weird confluence between essentially Far Eastern gambling and a kind of West Coast video game version of financial services, which is just a kind of collude, market manipulate, do whatever's necessary to drive the price of Bitcoin up as high as possible, as if it was the score in a video game. And these things have created a kind of cyclone, which is sweeping a lot of people along. And I think, for us, it's interesting and we're learning and we're watching this. But for the Tokyo taxi drivers that are putting their life savings into cryptocurrency, it's not a game.
And
I just feel that people are being swept along by this at the moment.
All right. Like the tulip craze. All right. So, hey, we've got about 3 minutes to close. So let me go around the table and ask you guys, I'll start with Jim, and ask you guys, what do you think is going to be the big move or the big news in 2018 in fintech? What's going to be the thing that we're going to be talking about in a year's time as to what's happened in 2018? Jim?
Actually, I think David started with it. I think it's going to be the application of AI across the board, but far beyond, right, we've talked about the iterations to more the disruption. So AI as opposed in the realm of targeting customers, in the realm of voice commerce. And I think we're going to see applications come up very quickly and some really innovative ones beyond risk and things like this that they're being used for now.
Cool. Ron, what do you think we're going to be talking about at the end of 2018?
With all apologies to your international audience, my comments will be a little U.S. focused. It'll be one of two things. Either A, Amazon will make some big move in financial services we'll all be talking about, or there'll be some incredibly big regulatory blunder on the part of the government.
Okay, fair enough. Theo?
It will be AI, but more in the sense of trying to merge health and wealth together, because we cannot look at each one of them as a silo.
Yeah, very interesting. And Dave?
Well, I've got a theory that, I mean, you remember a few years ago.
This is one of your crazy theories?
No, this one remember people were very concerned the U.S. economy would be devastated by North Korean super note counterfeiters who could make perfect $100 bills.
Keep it quick, Dave. 30 seconds.
We haven't heard much from those guys recently. I'm just saying, Bitcoin,
Okay. So
it's
North
Kim Jong-un behind
super
it all.
Dollars. All right, fair enough. All right, so guys, thank you very much for participating again in our end of year show. As usual, wonderful conversation. Ron, what's your Twitter handle?
R. Shevlin.
Dave?
At DGW Birch.
Theo?
TSB_DC.
And Jim?
It's at Jim Maroos.
At Jim Maroos, that's easy. All right, well, guys, thanks for joining us again on Breaking Banks for all of you. It's been a fantastic year. Thanks for participating in the show. Don't forget, next week we have Hanson Robotics, the creator of Sophia the robot, Ben Goertzel. And don't forget also to check out provoke.fm for our various podcasts, one of which, Snark Tank, is coming up soon with Ron Shevlin. Thanks again. Subscribe to the podcasts and vote us up on the show. And thanks for joining us on Breaking Banks. Have a great week. I'm Brett King. See you guys later.
You've been listening to Breaking Banks with host Brett King. Please be sure to join us again next Thursday at noon Pacific Time, 3 p.m. Eastern Time, for more of the latest in fintech news.